Welcome to Thrive Deeper, the show based on the Thrive Bible reading guides. This is an ongoing conversation about God's Word with Thrive author, Dr. Matthew Jacoby.
Welcome, listeners. It's Stu here, your host of the Thrive Today podcasts. Just before we jump into this episode of Thrive Deeper, we want to update you on our crowdfunding campaign to build the Thrive Today app. This app will bring together everything you love, Thrive podcasts, daily Bible reading guides, teaching video series, and a growing library of meaningful resources designed to deepen your faith journey.
It's a big step forward. It's a really big step forward for us, and it makes these resources so much more accessible. It means that we can put so much more in there. So please do get on board and help us do this.
We need to raise $30,000 to build the app, and the build won't begin until the full amount is raised. The great news is that we're halfway there. A huge thank you to those who have already supported this project, but we need to keep going to raise the required funding by the end of January 2026.
Yes, and thank you for your contributions.
Can we encourage you to partner with us in building this app, which we believe will bless thousands? Simply visit our website, thrivetoday.tv, and click the app crowdfunding link at the top. You can then select your level of support. Matt, let's jump into this episode of Thrive Deeper. Good morning, Matt.
Morning, Stu.
We are jumping into a brand new edition of Thrive and into what I have found one of the most challenging books of the Bible. I mean, there are others as well. We've just done Revelation, of course. We can't get a lot much of it. But, you know, some of the stuff, particularly at the beginning of Job, which we're going to talk about today, Book of Job, it's just really hard to reconcile in our minds. And so I'm really looking forward to us working through particularly the Book of Job and this series that we're working on now.
Yeah, this book is, to me, it's one of the most fascinating books because this is biblical philosophy, and what it's doing in its context is so interesting, and it's actually really crucial for us. I'm so glad this book is there because it actually asks one of the most commonly asked questions or speaks to what is perhaps the most common dilemma when it comes to faith, and that is the issue of suffering. But it's actually more than this. Is actually not just a book about suffering. This is a book about God's providence in how he rules the universe in the light of great evil and suffering.
I think for me, some of the stuff we're going to read about in chapters 1 and 2, and really we're going to focus on chapters 1 to 3 today because it kind of sets the scene for what comes next, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Listeners, welcome. Great to have you with Thrive Deeper. The Book of Job. The events likely took place in the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's when the events took place, but it was probably written in the time of Solomon as it forms sort of wisdom.
Or even later, partly because there are quotes from scriptures that probably wouldn't have existed at that time. So a lot of authors think, you know,
a bit later.
Even a little later again.
Okay. The interesting thing for me, particularly in chapters 1 and 2, is that we're told here that human behavior is observed by supernatural powers. So this whole thing of we're not fighting against flesh, we're fighting against powers and principalities is reflected here in this. But also that chapters 1 and 2, the first part could only have been revealed through divine revelation.
Yeah, there's some evidence that this is not a mere thought experiment and Job is not just a fictitious character. It seems like he is being presented as a historical character.
Yes.
And I should say a non-Israelite character. This is part of what's interesting about this story because he's not an Israelite. He lives in the land of Uz, which is most probably down towards what was Edom, so down in what we now today is southern Jordan, sort of the northern Arabian Peninsula. That idea of the wisdom of the East and Arabia was associated with this. So this is important, I think, and an interesting setting for this story. But Job is mentioned in Ezekiel, actually, as a character, you know, even if Job interceded for this city. So it's interesting that elsewhere, he's referred to as a historical character.
And I think to some degree, the recognition that chapters 1 and 2, Job didn't know is really central to understanding, in some ways, the purpose of the rest of the book.
Yeah.
You know, we read this and we know all of this. Oh, this was going on. But Job didn't know this was going on. And it speaks a lot to our desire, I think, or sense of need to be able to explain God.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. I think a big picture comment is probably in order, Stu, as we even approach this book, because what this pushes against is our desire, I think, to form very neat mechanistic ways of understanding how reality works. And this is particularly the case with this cause and effect notions that, you know, if you do something good, good will come to you. If you do something bad, bad will come to you. Now, whether it's karma or whether it's or whatever it is, I mean, even in a biblical view, and I mean, this is interesting too, because in a way, the book of Job belongs alongside the book of Proverbs as a very important qualification, because the book of Proverbs does affirm actually that principle of natural and even just retribution, the retributive principle, the idea that, you know, that those who are wise and righteous will be rewarded. And, you know, those who are foolish and wicked will be punished. Mm. And ultimately, we know from an ultimate perspective, that is true.
Yes.
But this is a, you know, both Job and also the book of Ecclesiastes, which we're going to look at as they take a terrestrial perspective, like a in this life perspective, because this is the perspective that we have. And actually, we're encouraged to recognize the limitations of our perspective.
Yeah.
This is a big thing that's happening in the book of Job, that we not try and guess what's going on. The fact that we have the insight that there is something going on in those first two chapters, it provides us with a hint that there is a something else. But it's interesting, those what happens in those first two chapters doesn't necessarily answer the dilemma as such, does it?
No.
It doesn't answer the key questions. In fact, it creates even more questions. It just hints.
Well, the questions are more then about God's character and Satan's.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So it pushes against this idea that the world sort of works like that. And in a way, there's something sobering about this book because, and it's worth recognizing, Stu, how tenaciously we hold on to that mechanistic way of thinking. Like even if we hear of someone that's something terrible has happened to them, our natural inclination, almost to comfort ourselves, or certainly we feel comforted if we can attribute their suffering to some cause. Oh, well, they probably did this or it's probably because of this. Or we try to explain it away because we so want the world.
Yeah, but it's also to for our own self-preservation. It's like if there's no reason that happened to them, there's a way that there's no reason that could happen to me.
Yeah.
And so we actually sit more comfortably with being able to justify it for them because that means, oh, okay, well, if I stay out of that, I'm going
to
be fine.
Yeah, we want to live in a world that's...
But that doesn't mean we can't feel it's unfair. I mean, unfair is a difficult word to use in a biblical context, but it feels
it is a difficult word.
It feels like...
And actually, justice is fine. I think there's initially a worldview thing here because part of what wisdom literature is... pointing us to is, I guess, what we can expect or how the world works. One of the things we see in the book of Job is that it's bigger, or God's ways are not confined to this sort of deterministic, almost a cause and effect sort of structure. Like in some ways, yes, we want the world to be ordered like that. And in fact, I think there's a sense of perhaps dread that we might have that anything could happen at any time for no particular reason. Now, that is actually the world that we live in, Stu. I mean, push back if you...
Because
we've got to remember in a biblical worldview, the world was perfectly ordered and everything that happened was right. And then human beings, the keystone in charge species that God created in his image, basically threw themselves and the world into a state of chaos.
Mm.
And so what reigns is now is chaos. Now, there is providence of God and a work of salvation through the chaos, but there is still a situation of chaos. And of course, in the biblical world, and in fact, in the Bible itself, this concern with order and chaos is very much present.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are even indications in the book of Job to the forces of chaos and so forth. That yes, God can subdue the forces of chaos, but he actually allows the world to be what it is so that we feel the symptoms of what's wrong. And it is actually wrong. When Lazarus died, for example, Jesus wept.
Yes.
Because it's just wrong, right? It's just, it shouldn't be that way.
It's not how it was made to be.
He didn't say, oh, look, no, there's a reason for, he did find purpose in it.
Yes.
Okay, but that's different to saying that it is somehow irrational, irrationally structured. It's part of some rationally structured scheme of things because the world has been thrown into chaos. And we are called to live ordered lives in the midst of the chaos. And God is doing something, ordering our steps and working out his perfect plan of salvation in the chaos, but it's very much in the chaos.
But let me just push back a little on that, because I think these are questions that have come up in my own mind over the years of reading the book of Job. It's like, yeah, but at the same time, God promises to his people, if you do this, it will go well for you.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got this constant tension between what feels like the promises of God. Because, you know, coming back to your statement about we live in a world of chaos, and I totally agree with you on that, and God is provident through the chaos. But where does prayer come in then? Like, is it,
yeah, good point.
You know, how do we pray for things and see God intervene for us if we're, anything could happen and we're just in the midst of it all?
Yeah, that's a good question. In some ways, that gets touched on in the book of Job. And in fact, God's blessing for our lives means that he does want to bring order to our lives, and he does want us to see the fruit of that order in our lives. I guess my point is that, so for example, one of the common themes throughout the Bible is the idea of God setting a pathway for his people, you know, and his word is a lamp to the path. And yes, there's a sense that, you know, it talks about him making our paths straight. It's in the Exodus imagery, it's the pathway through the sea with walls of water to the left and the right. So,
although I walk through the valley of the shadow of death,
that's right,
I'm not going to go through the valley. It's when I do, though, God's with me.
That's right. So there is a very important sense in which God staves off the forces of chaos.
Yes.
You know, Psalm 91 speaks to that. You know, he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. And it goes on to talk about a whole lot of, well, Exodus-like curses that we will be saved from. So the point is, you will be saved from the forces of chaos, like ultimately, but even in this life. And I think the point is that whatever happens to you, it won't thwart God's plan and God's purpose for you. But that doesn't mean that we never suffer from, I guess, a taste of the chaos of this world, because we do. We're all mortal. We suffer sickness. Ultimately, we will all suffer death.
And in some ways, it reminds us of our need for God, because
I think
if life was always going great for us, we'd soon forget.
Yeah. So I guess that experience of the chaos of the world is a really important part of orienting ourselves within reality. And wisdom is very much about orienting yourself within reality. Now, I mean, I think it's worth pointing out that Job, while he suffers immensely, he actually, in the end, he's still blessed.
Yes.
So in a sense, it's not completely contradicting that principle of blessing, that if you walk with God, ultimately you'll be blessed. You know, so for example, he has more children, but that doesn't compensate for the ones he lost.
Exactly.
For the ones that he lost. And then, of course, we've got to remember the eternal perspective as well, that this life is the valley of the shadow of death. Mm. And the whole purpose of this life is actually not necessarily, as we've been saying in the Thrive Perspectives podcast, it's not actually about being happy. It's about being purposeful.
Yes.
And knowing the joy of walking in the purpose of God. None of that answers the questions here. I think what the book of Job does is that it actually enables us to see the complexity of life, to realize that we can't grasp the purposes of God, as Paul says in Romans chapter 11, his ways are unsearchable.
Yes.
So, you know, that inscrutability of God's ways is a key theme of the book of Job as well.
And I think we see, as I said earlier on in chapters 1 and 2, we kind of see the backstory that most of us wouldn't see during our lives when we face things. There are principalities at work here, and that's where our prayer and our constant commitment to God's ways will, in a sense, provide a clear path for us, but it doesn't mean it'll eliminate the valleys and the struggles and the challenges.
Yeah, that's right. One more thing, Stu, before we jump in. This is a wisdom book. As I've said, it sits beside Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Its Proverbs is very neat. If you do this, this will be the case. The book of Job is, but it's the, you know, yes, that's true, but life is really complicated and don't think you can ever understand this. Now, as a wisdom book.
So Proverbs is more principles, not rules.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we talked about that when we looked at the book of Proverbs. Really what Job gains, and this is, I think, big picture, what Job gains in the end is wisdom. He's a righteous man, but what happens through his experiences and what he gains in the end is, I mean, he has this experience of God by which he gains the true sense of the fear of the Lord, right?
Yeah.
Which is
the beginning of
the understanding of the awesome transcendence of God, essentially.
And the beginning of all wisdom.
And it's the beginning of all wisdom. Mm. Now, speaking of Proverbs, Proverbs says in the Proverbs, get wisdom, though it cost you everything that you have, get wisdom, because it's more valuable than anything else. Now, Job gets wisdom and it does cost him everything that he has.
Yeah.
All right. Let's jump in.
Let's jump in. Chapters 1 and 2 really talk about the heavenly challenge.
It's the prologue.
It's the prologue. Yep. And again, Matt, should we not get too hung up in the semantics of this? I had talked to someone recently who's reading the book of Job as part of our daily Bible reading guide program. And how can Satan get in front of God? I thought God couldn't look on sin, kind of thing. Are we getting too tied down in the details of the stuff if that's what we do? Mm. Or
yeah, I think we've got to be careful not to be too sort of pedantic or perhaps, I mean, I don't want to say literalistic because I think this is as true a representation as our minds can cope with, right? We're just going to remember that, you know, the Bible is often talking about things that are beyond what our categories can really sort of understand. So perhaps the real sense in which these things happen is not something that we can even imagine or conceive. Yeah. So it's presented in very spatial,
so it's
temporal
the higher
terms.
Concepts that we want to understand rather than the detail.
Oh, yeah,
step.
I know, but this, I don't want to reduce this to abstract principles, because this is a story and it's something that happened, I think.
Yeah,
and
yes.
And so, yes, these things did happen, but what really happened behind, I mean, it's the same with a lot of, you know, like you could ask the same question, what's going on in Genesis chapter 3 behind the serpent and the, you know, we're told in very reductive sort of terms.
Well, where did the serpent even come from?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. We're told in very reductive terms that highlight certain sort of key, very broad brushstrokes. And I just think we've got to take that as true without assuming that that's all that there is to it.
Yes.
In a sense, perhaps that's the best.
It's what we need to know.
Or that the dimensions within which we're told are the only dimensions that there are, perhaps as a way of putting it. Okay. It still feels inadequate, but
anyway. All right. Well, I'm just going to read a little bit, and then you just interrupt when you want to speak to things. I won't read from verse 1 through to verse 5, but really what we know about Job is that he's introduced as blameless and upright. He's a man who fears God and shuns evil. He's wealthy.
Okay. Well, let me actually, I'm going to interrupt you.
All right. Well, let me finish. He's wealthy. He's devout, and he serves as a priestly figure for his family. So,
the important elements in those first 5 verses, Stu, first of all, the prologue wants there to be no doubt that he is blameless and upright, that nothing that happens happens because
he's done something
wrong. Okay. It's very emphatic about that, right? Blameless and upright, feared God, shunned evil. There's no more emphatic way that you could say this guy did not deserve what was coming to him.
Yeah.
Now, I know, again, from a Christian point of view, we're likely to say, oh, yes, but no one's perfect. And
that's not what they're trying
to say. It's not really the point. In fact, one of the friends makes that very point.
Yes.
You know, he says, look, no one's perfect, and therefore this is some sort of general discipline, you know, that you're – that's the point here, and the reason why it's so emphatic about his righteousness is that this wasn't discipline, this wasn't punishment, he didn't have this coming to him.
So take that off the table.
He was a man who was blessed, right? He had 7 sons and 3 daughters. The 7 and the 3, you know, they're very idealized numbers. Sons, and this is ancient world context, were seen as being more valuable than daughters. Not in the inherent sense of human dignity, but, you know, to have sons
in a
farming society and so forth was seen as being important. I mean, the addition of those, I mean, both 7 and 3 are important numbers, and then, you know, that he had 10 children, and there's even a symbolism in the numbers that's quite common in stories of the ancient world. Straight away, we can see this story is stylized it is stylized to convey things. So he has immense wealth and really immense wealth. The 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500. I mean, this enormous wealth, right?
Yeah.
He speaks about his children. Not only does his integrity and his righteousness cover the way that he lives, but he even is concerned about the behavior of his children.
Integrity of his kids.
And the integrity of his children. Mm. And again, this is part of his righteousness. Okay. His righteousness wasn't that they never
got it wrong,
that they never did anything wrong, but that this was a concern of his.
That it mattered to him.
And so in a biblical context, as a parent, you should be concerned about your kids in that sense. You can't control your kids, but part of his righteousness is that he is, in a sense, interceding, as you rightly said. Mm. He is acting in this priestly role, offering, it's interesting, burnt offerings.
Yes.
Which, and I mean, I know we could say, oh, what did he had some special revelation of? That's not the point. Mm. The point is, from this Jewish perspective, he is acting in this priestly role. Mm. And yes, he's sacrificing for them in the sense that therefore points to this. It basically extends this sense of he is the ideal.
Yeah.
He is what even we as Jewish people from the writer's perspective would idealize. Okay.
Right.
So that's important, lest there be any doubt that there's any charge that could be brought against this guy.
Good. I'm glad you cleared that up. And I think that is important. Absolutely. All right. Shall I go into verse 6? One day, the sons of God.
Oh, Stu.
I thought I'd stop there. I left the gap specifically for you.
The sons of God. Okay, version are you reading from there?
I'm reading from the CSB.
Okay, so that is actually a good and literal translation. And it's interesting that they've kept that because that's
usually
the CSB is usually a slightly more dynamic. It's not literal, but I appreciate the fact that they've kept that there because the NIV translation that I've got here says angels.
Right.
But in the Hebrew, it is sons of God. And the sons of God essentially refers to spirit, is a way of referring to spiritual beings. Now, it's interesting. Angels are a type of spiritual beings.
Right.
They are spiritual beings that are messengers because angel means messenger. So basically, what is being presented here is a sort of heavenly council.
Right.
Now, we see this elsewhere in Scripture, the idea of a heavenly council. Mm. It's difficult for us. I mean, look, even in John's, we've just been through Revelation, haven't we?
Exactly.
And even in John's visions of heaven, there is a sort of heavenly council. You know, again, the sense in which this is true is beyond probably what we can imagine. But nevertheless, this is what's happening here. And the heavenly council consists of spiritual beings who have some role in the world. And we also know that many of these spiritual beings have rebelled against God, but they are still under God's sovereignty. Mm. And they are still, even though they are in rebellion, they are still beholden to God and they are still made to serve God's purpose. And again, we see this in the book of Revelation, Stu, right?
Yes.
That we see God sending out evil spirits into the world to stir up the evil, to bring to the surface the hardness of people's hearts. So there is a, you know, to sort of almost as a sort of a judgment that will make what is bad worse. And all of that is depicted in the book of Revelation, completely under God's sovereignty. So here, the fact that these, and I'll let you read,
let me read a bit more in a moment. Now.
But the fact that they come and present themselves.
Yeah.
That is a sign that they are
under
all accountable
authority.
To God, whether good or evil.
Yeah. So one day the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them. The Lord asked Satan, "Where have you come from?" "From roaming through the earth," Satan answered him, "and walking around on it."
So in the Hebrew, it's actually, because Satan we think of as a personal name, but it's actually the Satan.
Yes, that's right.
The Satan or the accuser. This is, now there's some, you know, there's some debate over, is this the devil? Is this the same Satan as the dragon that we've been reading about in the book of Revelation and the
serpent
in the garden? Mm-hmm. Or is this just a generic accuser spirit? It doesn't really matter for the story, but I think I certainly lean towards this being Satan.
The Satan. Yeah.
Yeah. As in the red dragon, the serpent.
Yeah.
Because he is referred to in Revelation as the accuser of the brethren. And this is exactly what he's doing here.
Yeah.
So I think there is really good reason not just to take this as an accuser, but to take this as the accuser. It's interesting because if that's the case, then it explains the I'm roaming around the earth right now. Peter says, your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. I think it's that sort of thing. But there's also a boast here about his, I've got free reign. I really think there's a boast here before God. I've got free reign.
Yeah.
Now, why would Satan have free reign in a world that belongs to God? This is the problem that you bring up. Why would he have free reign, or why could he claim to have free reign in a world that belongs to God? And the answer is because God gave the world to us.
And we gave it to Satan.
And we gave it to Satan. Mm. And when God empowered us to rule over the earth, it was real authority. Romans 11:29 says the gifts and the call of God are irrevocable.
Yeah.
It means that the decision that we made to essentially abdicate our position as princes of this world and give it over to Satan, who Jesus referred to as the prince of this world.
Yes.
That means that in a sense, we're harboring a criminal, as it were.
Yeah.
We've abdicated, you know, because that terminology that Jesus uses to describe Satan, the prince of this world, that's our role, right?
Yes.
But he's taken that role. So I think there's a
bit of a bragging in front of God.
That's right. And he keeps that role. Yeah. As long as we are in sin, he keeps that role because we are under his authority as long as we are guilty and in sin. Hmm. This is why Satan accuses people, because that's his claim to authority. As long as these people are guilty, they're under my power. And so he has a sort of, you know, it's often said Satan is a legalist. He has a sort of claim because as long as we perpetually give him permission, which we do.
Yes.
As long as we remain in sin. I'm not talking about just when we sin. I'm talking about remaining in sin,
yes,
right? Because sin is a state of being. It's being out of relationship with God. As long as we are alienated in enmity, you know, against God, we are under Satan's authority. And in a sense, we are perpetually permission giving for him. Mm. So this perhaps accounts for what God says, right? Because it's like he's saying, I can go wherever I want.
Yeah.
Because these human beings have given me free reign.
And I think there's another element of the taunt there because my translation says, and walking around on it. And if we remember in the garden, God came and walked with Adam and Eve. And then towards the end, it says, they will be, and I will walk with them when God comes back and we're restored. So this whole sense of, I can walk with them, but you can't in a sense, you know.
Yeah, that's
I feel
right.
like there's the taunt right there. So then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? No one else on earth is like him, a man of perfect integrity who fears God and turns away from evil.
So in other words, and this makes sense, more sense in the light of what I just said, I think, because why would God respond that way to what Satan just said about roaming around the earth?
Because he's challenging the taunt.
That's right. He's challenging the taunt. Mm. Here is a man that you have no authority over, like in a sense, and in a sense, such a man who trusts God like
is a threat to him,
is a threat to your authority.
Yeah.
So what Satan needs to do is he needs to accuse, do what he does, and accuse to actually show that no, he doesn't really trust in God. He doesn't really love God.
Yeah.
See, it's because again, notice the question here, I mean, this is important, Stu, because it's not just about his behavior.
No.
It's about his heart.
Yes.
And what Satan is going to question, oh yeah, sure, he does all the right things.
But why?
And what he's going to question is the heart. This is so important, right?
Yes.
Because the life that God calls us to is not just a life of keeping rules.
No, that's right.
It's all about the heart. And what Satan is going to point to is the heart.
And what Satan tries to suggest is that it's transactional.
Yeah,
so he says,
right.
Satan answered the Lord, does Job fear God for nothing? Haven't you placed a hedge around him, his household and everything he owns? You've blessed the work of his hands and his possessions are spread out in the land. But stretch out your hand and strike everything he owns and he will surely curse you to your face. What Satan's trying to say there by my reading is it's just a transactional thing.
Yeah,
He praises you because he's really happy with how things are going. you take that away and it's not about who you are, God, or his heart. It's just about the transaction. Yeah. Yeah.
And so God says, okay.
Yep. Very well.
Let's try this out. Let's test him now. Now, this is going to seem mean, isn't it?
Yep.
But like, I mean, we know from scripture, God tests our faith. He tests our devotion to him to bring it to the surface and to strengthen it. And can God do this? Well, he is God.
Mm.
So this is what happens next.
But I think the important thing here is he allows, he doesn't make it happen. So it's Satan that goes and does this thing. God just allows him to.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So very well, the Lord told Satan, everything he owns is in your power. However, you must not lay a hand on Job himself. Satan went out from the Lord's presence. One day, when Job's sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and reported, while the oxen were plowing and the donkeys grazing nearby, the Sabians swooped down and took them away. They struck down the servants with the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. He was still speaking when another messenger came and reported, a lightning storm struck from heaven. It burned up the sheep and the servants and devoured them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. That messenger was still speaking when yet another came and reported, the Chaldeans formed three bands, made a raid on the camels and took them away. They struck down the servants with the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. He was still speaking when another messenger came and reported, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. Suddenly a powerful wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on the young people so that they died, and I alone have escaped to tell you.
Yeah, this sequence of events, Stu, is interesting because it's all enormously unlikely. Each of these things. So it can't be said, oh, yeah, this would happen.
Just justified.
This could happen to anyone.
Yeah.
Okay. So for a start, the Sabaeans live like 1,000 miles away. You know, this is like down in Yemen or something.
Right. How'd they even get there?
Yeah. What? The Sabaeans? Yeah. Very unlikely. Mm. Then lightning comes. Mm. Okay. In my translation, it says the fire of God fell from. It's interesting because in the NIV here is more literal. Isn't it interesting with translation?
Yes.
Because in this case, this is more literal, but it is referring to lightning. Now, you know, lightning may strike.
But what are the odds?
But unlikely. Yeah, that's right. You know,
they're pretty minor odds. Yeah.
I mean, it burned up the sheep and the servants. So this is not just an isolated, this is lightning coming and striking.
And we're talking 7,000 sheep.
That's right. And then the Chaldeans. I mean, they're way away. The Chaldeans in this time were probably closer, but still a fair way away, right? Probably up to the north. Again, unlikely. Then this wind comes to and it says it struck the four corners of the house.
Which way does a wind blow?
Which way does a wind blow? I mean, this is a sort of tornado, and tornadoes are not part of the climate in this area.
No.
So this is all really unlikely, and that's the point, actually.
That's a great point.
The point is that, I mean, it's one thing for natural disasters and whatever, but this is something that pushes even, this is like supernatural disasters.
And then more than that, the individual occurrences, but then for them all to happen, almost simultaneously.
That's right. Yeah.
Just adds another whole dimension of
Exactly. So it's no wonder that you said, okay, God allows this, but it's interesting when in Job's complaints, he never says someone else has done this. This is completely it's very much God has done this. Now,
under God's authority, because it's happened under God's authority. Yeah.
So his issue is with God. Now, actually, in a way, Job is right about that. But of course, the insight that we're given in these first two chapters is that there's other things going on as well. You know what I mean? It's it does give us at least this sense that it's not like God came very directly and did these things, that there are malevolent forces at work in the heavenly realms that are part of the very unfortunate state of the world that we live in. And so I think that's where this little bit of insight that we have, that Job, of course, didn't have, helps a bit. It doesn't answer the questions, but it does point to something bigger.
And of course, Satan wants to assert his authority to be the prince of this world.
Yeah.
Constantly. So he's always looking for those opportunities. So then Job stood up, tore his robe and shaved his head. He fell to the ground and worshipped.
Yeah.
I mean, fell to the ground and worshipped. Yeah. I don't know that I'd be, if all of that had happened to me and my family, I'm not sure where worship would be in the list of priorities, let me just say. But he worshipped, saying, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will leave this life. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Praise the name of the Lord. Throughout all this, Job did not sin or blame God for anything.
Yeah, so basically God was right. He is a godly man and his heart is for God. And his reaction is the ultimate expression of that because, you know, he doesn't curse God. He does what, you know, the story in 2 Samuel chapter 11, 12, when David sinned against God with Bathsheba and the child of that union passes away and, you know, he's praying and praying for the child, but that child dies. And, you know, it says up, he got up and he washed himself and he put on lotions and he went into the house of God and worshipped. Right? Yeah. Because there's a sense of, I will accept from the Lord's hand. Like it's the ultimate sort of sense of submission. I will accept from the Lord's hand what the Lord gives because it's a declaration that it is God's right both to give and to take away. We're not entitled to anything.
Yes.
So yet again, Job is not, he doesn't feel entitled to anything. This is the point of this. This is where this outweighs all the blessing that he's given. None of that does he feel entitled to because he's a righteous man.
Yes.
So in other words, it's not transactional. Yeah.
And so as you've said before in podcasts, past episodes a few times, and I think it's a really strong point to make, we often ask the question, why is this happening to me? And the better question is, why not?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so Satan's second test of Job. One day, the sons of God came again to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them to present himself before the Lord. The Lord asked Satan, where have you come from? From roaming through the earth, Satan answered him, and walking around on it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? No one else on earth is like him, a man of perfect integrity who fears God and turns away from evil. He still retains his integrity even though you incited me against him to destroy him without just cause.
Okay, so that's the repetition here is important.
Yep.
It's an important literary device because he, you know, he's passed the test in a sense, to put it rather crudely. But the statement there that God makes that he maintains his integrity, though you incited me against him. Mm. It's the without any reason is a key there.
Just cause.
Yeah, without cause, right? That is for no purpose.
Yes.
Because there's no rationality behind any of this. This is, I think, it's actually an important point for this book, right? What Satan is doing, he is, in a sense, the cause of the chaos. He is acting somewhat chaotically, right?
True to form.
That's right. His challenge to God, you know, you think that Job is da-da-da-da-da, but you're wrong. I mean, that all is a recipe of chaos, that doubting God, that all of that, that actually is chaos. So this is God, in a sense, charging Satan with doing things without any rational basis. This is the forces of chaos at work. So again, lest we say, oh, what is being presented in the first two chapters is the reason why that happened to Job.
No, that's a good point, yeah.
There's no reason.
There's no reason.
There's no reason in it. That's the point.
Satan goes on to say, skin for skin, Satan answered the Lord. A man will give up everything he owns in exchange for his life, but stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face.
Mm.
Very well, the Lord's told Satan, he is in your power, only spare his life. So Satan left the Lord's presence and infected Job with incurable boils from the sole of his foot to the top of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery to scrape himself while he sat among the ashes. His wife said to him, do you still retain your integrity? Curse God and die. You speak as a foolish woman speaks, he told her. Should we accept only good from God and not adversity? Throughout all this, Job did not sin in what he said.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of a echo of Genesis chapter 3 there with, you know, the man and the woman.
Yep.
This is not indicting women generally, for goodness sake. It's meant to sort of echo that somewhat. Notice here too how emphatic it is about the fact that God is allowing this. This is happening under God's authority and he is allowing. It doesn't mean it's good, but he allows things to happen that are not good. And again, the question is why? And the whole point of this book is that we can't fathom why. We just got to stop short of saying it's
why.
Because of this. Now, we could go with, look, what is the Westminster Shorter Catechism, you know, answers the question, what is the chief end of man? It is to glorify God and enjoy him forever, right? So to glorify God, what happens? Job glorifies God, right? So we could say all of this happened so that God could be glorified in Job's worship. That's true. It's just a bit too neat. And this is interesting because everything, well, I mean, we'll say more about this, because in what follows in the efforts to understand this, and most of the body of this book from here is the efforts of his friends that we're going to meet soon to understand or make sense of this.
We'll feel that they have to try to explain it away.
Yeah. You know? And it's that endeavor that essentially the book of Job is a warning against.
Yeah. Which is the same.
Don't try to offer an explanation. Don't try to understand it or grasp it because it's beyond.
Yeah. Which is the same as asking the question, well, if God didn't want us to sin, why did he put the tree of knowledge of good and evil in the Garden of Eden?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I mean, the interesting thing too is that everything that his friends go on to say, there's actually nothing that's theologically untrue in what they say. Everything that they say is theologically valid, but it's foolish. It's like you can say true things and still be foolish.
Yes.
That's the nature of wisdom, right? Yes. What his friends lack is not right theology. Mm. All of their theology is fine. What they lack is wisdom. That's where the body of this all goes. Okay. So he replies to his wife, and to emphasize the fact, you are talking like a foolish woman, right? Mm. This is a book about foolishness versus wisdom, essentially. Mm. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? Wonderful rhetorical question.
Yeah.
In all of this, Job did not sin in what he said. Now, Job does repent in the end. It's actually because of a deeper issue that comes up from here on.
Okay.
That we'll confront as we go. Because even Job, he's going to challenge, well, not challenge, well, in a way,
question.
Yeah, he's going to question God, in a way, bring God into the dock to some extent.
Which he then gets criticized for by his friends as well, of course.
Yeah. And look, in the end, Job is commended, of course. Mm. In the end, Job is commended. But these are the kinds of things. So let's meet his friends.
So when Job's three friends, Eliphaz, Temanite, Bildad, Shuhite.
Well done.
And Zophar, the Naamathite, heard about all this adversity that had happened to him, each of them came from his home. They met together to go and offer sympathy and to comfort him. When they looked from a distance, they could barely recognize him. They wept aloud, and each man tore his robe and threw dust into the air and on his head. Then they sat down on the ground with him 7 days and nights, but no one spoke a word to him because they saw that his suffering was very intense.
Yeah, so
that's probably the best thing his friends have done.
This is the best thing that they did, they actually, sitting in silence. The problem happens when they open their mouths. Yep. So everyone starts well, actually. I mean, this is the interesting thing in these two chapters.
Yeah.
Everyone starts well.
Yeah.
And then from here, you know, that sets up what happens, really. And it's the body of this book from chapter 3 to the epilogue that we'll get to. This is somewhat, and I'll warn readers, like, I realize this, it's somewhat laborious to read through.
It feels repetitive.
But, yeah, but everything that happens from here on is what we do.
Yes, we do. Absolutely, we do.
And the reason it's given so much time and so much space is because this is the stuff we go on and on and on about. This is the stuff we can't let go of. We try to understand things. We're talking and talking and trying to, our minds get in this sort of rational feedback loops of trying to grasp and try to understand. And I just don't understand. I can't, you know. And look, in Job's case, it's completely understandable because he's just suffered these terrible things.
And of course, remember, he didn't know any of the stuff we've just read in chapter
1. And he doesn't know anything that we know. Mm. I mean, whether that would have helped is a
doubtful.
Right. But so the on and on and on is actually important.
Because it's what we do.
It's actually, this is actually a beautiful poetic book as well. I mean, this is beautiful poetry throughout this book. I mean, it's very tragic, but it's also philosophically brilliant because, I mean, what's brilliant about this is, again, I'll say everything that the friends say is correct, and yet it's just not quite right. It's not wise. And so there's a real brilliance to what flows poetically from the text at this point. But let's look at Job's reactions, and then in the next episode, we'll reflect on the big discussion that ensues. Let me just point out some
highlights, I think. Yeah, would be good.
Highlights. I think that's probably the wrong word. Job begins by cursing the day of his birth. Yeah. I should never have been born. The issue here is, why was I even born? This is the first question. If, and this is actually a question, Stu, that, I mean, even within philosophy, there are philosophers like Emile Cioran and the South African philosopher David Benatar that have written books. Emile Cioran's is a Romanian French philosopher that wrote a book called Better Never to Have Been Born. And David Benatar wrote a book of the same
sort of theme,
sort of ilk. Mm. And you know, the you know David Benatar's theory is what's called an antinatalist. The theory is that this life is inevitably a life of an endless flight from suffering and discontent, and we never really arrive at contentment, and we never, you know, we can never ward off suffering. So bringing life into this world is a evil, is a great evil. I know that's bleak, but these philosophers feel that they're being philosophically consistent from their atheistic worldview. There's a film that interesting film that plays on this. It's a Lebanese film called Capernaum that plays on that very theme.
Right.
It's about a child that goes through all of these terrible things and ends up suing his parents for bringing him into this world.
Right.
This has been an enduring theme of reflection. My point is that this is an enduring theme of reflection. Why were we even born? If life is
going to be so difficult.
So difficult. What's even the point of life? Like this is
it almost feels like torture.
So straight up from the start, Job raises the biggest question of all. What is the meaning of life anyway?
Yeah.
Why are we even here? What's even the point of being alive? So, you know, may the day of my birth perish, the night that said a boy is conceived. That day may it turn to darkness. May God above not care about it. May no light shine upon it. May gloom and utter darkness claim it once more. It's very poetic. It's tragically beautiful.
Why was I not born, stillborn? You know, he goes on about not even wanting to enter the world.
Because he says, for now I would be lying down in peace.
Yeah.
I would be asleep at rest, right? This is not Sabbath. There's no Sabbath here. I'm in turmoil. Verse 20, why is light given? He starts with himself. Why was I even born? Mm. Then why didn't I perish at birth? Then why is anyone born, right?
Yeah.
Verse 20, he generalizes the question. Why is life given to those in misery and life to the bitter of soul, to those who long for death that does not come, who search for it more than hidden treasure, who are filled with gladness and rejoice when they reach the grave? Why is life given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? I mean, it's a big, big question.
Yeah.
And so the book of Job, it's not just about suffering. It's a book about the providence of God. It's a book about the way that God rules the world. It's a book that tells us that such questions, even if they could be answered, even if God wanted to answer those questions, it's not for us to interrogate God. But even if God wanted to give us the answer, our finite minds could not fathom the way that all of this works. And so this is the beginning of wisdom, that God's ways are infinitely beyond our ways. God is infinitely beyond what we can think and imagine. This is the fear of the Lord, and the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. That's what the book of Job is all about.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Thrive Deeper. Our home on the internet is thrivetoday.tv. You can contact us, ask questions, see all our resources and much more at our website, thrivetoday.tv. We really appreciate the questions and thoughts about what you're reading as we go through the Bible with Thrive. Until next time, our prayer is that these shows will inspire you to go deeper and thrive.